Book I, The Two Lads, Chapter I of The Sign of the Sun in Kettley. Sir Daniel and his men lay in and about Kettley that night, warmly quartered and well patrolled. But the Knight of Tunstall was one who never rested from money getting, and even now, when he was on the brink of an adventure which should make or mar him, he was up an hour after midnight to squeeze poor neighbors. He was one who trafficked greatly in disputed inheritances, it was his way to buy out the most unlikely claimant, and then, by the favor he curried with great lords about the king, procure unjust decisions in his favor, or, if that was too roundabout, to seize the disputed manor by force of arms, and rely on his influence and Sir Oliver's cunning in the law to hold what he had snatched. Kettley was one such place, it had come very lately into his clutches, he still met with opposition from the tenants, and it was to overawed discontent that he had led his troops that way. By 2 in the morning, Sir Daniel sat in the inn-room, close by the fireside, for it was cold at that hour among the fens of Kettley. By his elbow stood a pottle of spiced ale. He had taken off his visored headpiece, and sat with his bald head and thin, dark visage resting on one hand, wrapped warmly in a sanguine-colored cloak. At the lower end of the room about a dozen of his men stood sentry over the door or lay asleep on benches, and somewhat nearer hand, a young lad, apparently of 12 or 13, was stretched in a mantle on the floor. The host of the Sun stood before the great man. "Now, mark me, mine host," Sir Daniel said, "follow but mine orders, and I shall be your good lord ever. I must have good men for head boroughs, and I will have Adam a more high constable, see to it narrowly. If other men be chosen, it shall avail you nothing, rather it shall be found to your sore cost. For those that have paid rent to Walsingham I shall take good measure of you among the rest, mine host." "Good night," said the host, "I will swear upon the cross of Holywood I did but pay to Walsingham upon compulsion. Nay, bully knight, I love not the rogue Walsinghams, they were as poor as thieves, bully knight. Give me a great lord like you. Nay, ask me among the neighbors, I am stout for Brackley." "It may be," said Sir Daniel, dryly. "Ye shall then pay twice." The innkeeper made a horrid grimace, but this was a piece of bad luck that might readily befall a tenant in these unruly times, and he was perhaps glad to make his peace so easily. "Bring up yon fellow, Selden," cried the knight. And one of his retainers led up a poor, cringing old man, as pale as a candle, and all shaking with the fen fever. "Sirrah," said Sir Daniel, "your name?" "An't please your worship," replied the man, "my name is Kendall Kendall of Shoreby, at your good worship's pleasure." "I have heard you ill reported on," returned the knight. "Ye deal in treason, rogue, ye trudge the country leasing, why are heavily suspicioned of the death of Severals? How, fellow, are ye so bold? But I will bring you down." "Right honourable and my reverend lord," the man cried, "here is some hodgepodge, saving your good presence. I am but a poor private man, and have hurt none." "The under-sheriff did report of you most vilely," said the knight. "Seize me," saith he, "that title of Shoreby." "Kendall, my good lord, Kendall is my poor name," said the unfortunate.
"Kendall or title, it is all one," replied Sir Daniel, coolly. "For, by my sooth, why are here and I do mightily suspect your honesty. If ye would save your neck, write me swiftly an obligation for £20.
"For £20, my good lord," cried Kendall. "Here is midsummer madness. My whole estate amounteth not to 70 shillings.
"Kendall or Tyndall," returned Sir Daniel, grinning, "I will run my peril of that loss. Write me down 20, and when I have recovered all I may, I will be good lord to you, and pardon you the rest."
"Alas! My good lord, it may not be, I have no skill to write," said Kendall.
"Well a day," returned the knight. "Here, then, is no remedy. Yet I would fain have spared you, Tyndall, had my conscience suffered. Selden, take me this old shrew softly to the nearest helm, and hang me him tenderly by the neck, where I may see him at my riding. Fare ye well, good Master Kendall, dear Master Tyndall, why our post haste for paradise, fare ye then well."
"Nay, my right pleasant lord," replied Kendall, forcing an obsequious smile, "and ye be so masterful, as doth right well become you, I will even, with all my poor skill, do your good bidding."
"Friend," quoth Sir Daniel, "ye will now write 20. Go to. Why are too cunning for a livelihood of 70 shillings? Selden, see him write me this in good form, and have it duly witnessed." And Sir Daniel, who was a very merry knight, none merrier in England, took a drink of his mulled ale, and lay back, smiling. Meanwhile, the boy upon the floor began to stir, and presently sat up and looked about him with a scare.
"Hither," said Sir Daniel,
And as the other rose at his command and came slowly towards him, he leaned back and laughed outright. "By the rood," he cried, "a sturdy boy." The lad flushed crimson with anger, and darted a look of hate out of his dark eyes. Now that he was on his legs, it was more difficult to make certain of his age. His face looked somewhat older in expression, but it was as smooth as a young child's, and in bone and body he was unusually slender, and somewhat awkward of gait. "Ye have called me, Sir Daniel," he said. "Was it to laugh at my poor plight?"
"Nay, now, let laugh," said the knight.
"Good shrew, let laugh, I pray you. An ye could see yourself, I warrant ye would laugh the first."
"Well," cried the lad, flushing, "ye shall answer this when ye answer for the other. Laugh while yet ye may."
"Nay, now, good cousin," replied Sir Daniel, with some earnestness, "think not that I mock at you, except in mirth, as between kinsfolk and singular friends. I will make you a marriage of 1,000 pounds, go to, and cherish you exceedingly. I took you, indeed, roughly, as the time demanded, but from henceforth I shall ungrudgingly maintain and cheerfully serve you. Ye shall be Mrs. Shelton, Lady Shelton, by my troth. For the lad promiseth bravely. Tut. Ye will not shy for honest laughter, it purgeth melancholy. They are no rogues who laugh, good cousin. Good mine host, lay me a meal now for my cousin, Master John. Sit ye down, sweetheart, and eat."
"Nay," said Master John, "I will break no bread. Since ye force me to this sin, I will fast for my soul's interest. But, good mine host, I pray you of courtesy give me a cup of fair water, I shall be much beholden to your courtesy indeed."
"Ye shall have a dispensation, go to," cried the knight. "Shalt be well shriven, by my faith. Content you, then, and eat." But the lad was obstinate, drank a cup of water, and, once more wrapping himself closely in his mantle, sat in a far corner, brooding. In an hour or two, there arose a stir in the village of sentries challenging and the clatter of arms and horses, and then a troop drew up by the inn door, and Richard Shelton, splashed with mud, presented himself upon the threshold.
"Save you, Sir Daniel," he said.
"How? Dickie Shelton?" cried the knight, and at the mention of Dick's name the other lad looked curiously across. "What maketh Bennett Hatch?"
"Please you, Sir Knight, to take cognizance of this packet from Sir Oliver, wherein are all things fully stated," answered Richard, presenting the priest's letter.
"And please you farther, ye were best make all speed to Risingham, for on the way hither we encountered one riding furiously with letters, and by his report, my lord of Risingham was sore bested, and lacked exceedingly your presence."
"How say you? Sore bested?" returned the knight.
"Nay, then, we will make speed sitting down, good Richard. As the world goes in this poor realm of England, he that rides softliest rides surest. Delay, they say, begetteth peril, but it is rather the sitch of doing that undoes men, mark it, Dick. But let me see, first, what cattle ye have brought. Selden, a link here at the door." And Sir Daniel strode forth into the village street, and, by the red glow of a torch, inspected his new troops. He was an unpopular neighbor and an unpopular master, but as a leader in war he was well beloved by those who rode behind his pennant. His dash, his proved courage, his forethought for the soldier's comfort, even his rough jibes, were all to the taste of the bold blades in Jack and Sally.
"Nay, by the rood," he cried, "what poor dogs are these? Here be some as crooked as a bow, and some as lean as a spear. Friends, ye shall ride in the front of the battle, I can spare you, friends. Mark me this old villain on the piebald. A 2-year mutton riding on a hog would look more soldierly. Ha! Clipsby, are ye there, old rat? Why are a man I could lose with a good heart? Ye shall go in front of all, with a bull's eye painted on your jack, to be the better butt for archery, sirrah, ye shall show me the way."
"I will show you any way, Sir Daniel, but the way to change sides," returned Clipsby, sturdily. Sir Daniel laughed to guffaw.
"Why, well said," he cried. "Hast a shrewd tongue in thy mouth, go to. I will forgive you for that merry word. Selden, see them fed, both man and brute." The knight re-entered the inn.
"Now, friend Dick," he said, "fall to. Here is good ale and bacon. Eat, while that I read."
Sir Daniel opened the packet, and as he read his brow darkened. When he had done he sat a little, musing. Then he looked sharply at his ward.
"Dick," said he, "why have seen this penny rhyme?"
The lad replied in the affirmative.
"It bears your father's name," continued the knight, "and our poor shrew of a parson is, by some mad soul, accused of slaying him. He did most eagerly deny it, answered Dick.
He did? Cried the knight, very sharply. Heed him not. He has a loose tongue, he babbles like a jack sparrow. Some day, when I may find the leisure, Dick, I will myself more fully inform you of these matters. There was one Duckworth shrewdly blamed for it, but the times were troubled, and there was no justice to be got.
It befell at the Moat House? Dick ventured, with a beating at his heart.
It befell between the Moat House and Hollywood, replied Sir Daniel, calmly, but he shot a covert glance, black with suspicion, at Dick's face. And now, added the knight, speed you with your meal, ye shall return to Tunstall with a line from me.
Dick's face fell sorely.
Prithee, Sir Daniel, he cried, send one of the villains. I beseech you let me to the battle. I can strike a stroke, I promise you.
I misdoubt it not, replied Sir Daniel, sitting down to write. But here, Dick, is no honor to be won. I lie in Kettley till I have sure tidings of the war, and then write to join me with the conqueror.
Cry not on cowardice, it is but wisdom, Dick, for this poor realm so tosseth with rebellion, and the king's name and custody so changeth hands, that no man may be certain of the morrow.
Tosspot and Shuttlewit run in, but my lord good counsel sits a one side, waiting.
With that, Sir Daniel, turning his back to Dick, and quite at the farther end of the long table, began to write his letter, with his mouth on one side, for this business of the black arrow stuck sorely in his throat.
Meanwhile, young Shelton was going on heartily enough with his breakfast, when he felt a touch upon his arm, and a very soft voice whispering in his ear.
Make not a sign, I do beseech you, said the voice, but of your charity tell me the straight way to Hollywood.
Beseech you, now, good boy, comfort a poor soul in peril and extreme distress, and set me so far forth upon the way to my repose.
Take the path by the windmill, answered Dick, in the same tone, it will bring you to Tilferry, there inquire again.
And without turning his head, he fell again to eating. But with the tail of his eye he caught a glimpse of the young lad called Master John stealthily creeping from the room.
Why, thought Dick, he is as young as I. Good boy doth he call me? An I had known, I should have seen the varlet hanged ere I had told him. Well, if he goes through the fen, I may come up with him and pull his ears.
Half an hour later, Sir Daniel gave Dick the letter, and bade him speed to the Moat House. And, again, some half an hour after Dick's departure, a messenger came, in hot haste, from my lord of Risingham.
Sir Daniel, the messenger said, ye lose great honour, by my sooth. The fight began again this morning ere the dawn, and we have beaten their van and scattered their right wing. Only the main battle standeth fast. An we had your fresh men, we should tilt you them all into the river.
What, Sir Knight? Will ye be the last? It stands not with your good credit.
Nay, cried the knight, I was but now upon the march.
Selden, sound me the tucket.
Sir, I am with you on the instant. It is not 2 hours since the more part of my command came in, Sir Messenger.
What would ye have?
Spurring is good meat, but yet it killed the charger.
Bustle, boys.
By this time the tucket was sounding cheerily in the morning, and from all sides Sir Daniel's men poured into the main street and formed before the inn. They had slept upon their arms, with chargers saddled, and in 10 minutes 50 men-at-arms and archers, cleanly equipped and briskly disciplined, stood ranked and ready. The chief part were in Sir Daniel's livery, murrey and blue, which gave the greater show to their array. The best armed rode first, and away out of sight, at the tail of the column, came the sorry reinforcement of the night before. Sir Daniel looked with pride along the line.
Here be the lads to serve you in a pinch, he said.
They are pretty men, indeed, replied the messenger. It but augments my sorrow that ye had not marched the earlier.
Well, said the knight, what would ye?
The beginning of a feast and the end of a fray, Sir Messenger, and he mounted into his saddle.
Why?
How now?
He cried.
John.
Joanna.
Nay, by the sacred rood.
Where is she?
Host, where is that girl?
Girl, Sir Daniel?
Cried the landlord.
Nay, sir, I saw no girl.
Boy, then, dotard!
Cried the knight.
Could ye not see it was a wench? She in the murrey-colored mantle she that broke her fast with water, rogue where is she?
Nay, the saints bless us.
Master John, ye called him, said the host.
Well, I thought none evil.
He is gone.
I saw her in the stable a good hour agone, I was saddling a grey horse.
Now, by the rood! Cried Sir Daniel, the wench was worth £500 to me and more.
Sir Knight, observed the messenger,
with bitterness, while that ye are here, roaring for 500 pounds, the realm of England is elsewhere being lost and won.
It is well said, replied Sir Daniel. Selden, fall me out with 6 crossbowmen, hunt me her down. I care not what it cost, but, at my returning, let me find her at the moat house. Be it upon your head. And now, Sir Messenger, we march.
And the troop broke into a good trot, and Selden and his 6 men were left behind upon the street of Ketley, with the staring villagers.
Chapter 2 in the Fen. It was near 6 in the May morning when Dick began to ride down into the Fen upon his homeward way. The sky was all blue, the jolly wind blew loud and steady, the windmill sails were spinning, and the willows over all the Fen rippling and whitening like a field of corn. He had been all night in the saddle, but his heart was good and his body sound, and he rode right merrily. The path went down and down into the marsh, till he lost sight of all the neighbouring landmarks but Ketley Windmill on the knoll behind him, and the extreme top of Tunstall Forest far before. On either hand there were great fields of blowing reeds and willows, pools of water shaking in the wind, and treacherous bogs, as green as emerald, to tempt and to betray the traveller. The path lay almost straight through the morass. It was already very ancient, its foundation had been laid by Roman soldiery, in the lapse of ages much of it had sunk, and every here and there, for a few hundred yards, it lay submerged below the stagnant waters of the Fen. About a mile from Ketley, Dick came to one such break in the plain line of causeway, where the reeds and willows grew dispersedly like little islands and confused the eye. The gap, besides, was more than usually long. It was a place where any stranger might come readily to mischief, and Dick bethought him, with something like a pang, of the lad whom he had so imperfectly directed. As for himself, one look backward to where the windmill sails were turning black against the blue of heaven, one look forward to the high ground of Tunstall Forest, and he was sufficiently directed and held straight on, the water washing to his horse's knees, as safe as on a highway. Halfway across, and when he had already sighted the path rising high and dry upon the farther side, he was aware of a great splashing on his right, and saw a grey horse, sunk to its belly in the mud, and still spasmodically struggling. Instantly, as though it had divined the neighbourhood of help, the poor beast began to neigh most piercingly. It rolled, meanwhile, a bloodshot eye, insane with terror, and as it sprawled wallowing in the quag, clouds of stinging insects rose and buzzed about it in the air. Alack! Thought Dick, can the poor lad have perished? There is his horse, for certain, a brave grey. Nay, comrade, if thou criest to me so piteously, I will do all man can to help thee. Shalt not lie there to drown by inches. And he made ready his crossbow, and put a quarrel through the creature's head. Dick rode on after this act of rugged mercy, somewhat sobered in spirit, and looking closely about him for any sign of his less happy predecessor in the way. I would I had dared to tell him further, he thought, for I fear he has miscarried in the slough. And just as he was so thinking, a voice cried upon his name from the causeway side, and, looking over his shoulder, he saw the lad's face peering from a clump of reeds. Are ye there? He said, reining in. Ye lay so close among the reeds that I had passed you by. I saw your horse bemired, and put him from his agony, which, by my sooth, an ye had been a more merciful rider, ye had done yourself. But come forth out of your hiding. Here be none to trouble you. Nay, good boy, I have no arms, nor skill to use them if I had, replied the other, stepping forth upon the pathway.
Why call me boy? Cried Dick. Why are not, I trow, the elder of us twain?
Good Master Shelton, said the other, prithee forgive me. I have none the least intention to offend. Rather I would in every way beseech your gentleness and favour, for I am now worse bested than ever, having lost my way, my cloak, and my poor horse. To have a riding rod and spurs, and never a horse to sit upon. And before all, he added, looking ruefully upon his clothes before all, to be so sorrowly besmirched.
Tut! Cried Dick. Would ye mind a ducking? Blood of wound or dust of travel, that's a man's adornment.
Nay, then, I like him better plain, observed the lad. But, prithee, how shall I do?
Prithee, good Master Richard, help me with your good counsel. If I come not safe to Hollywood, I am undone.
Nay, said Dick, dismounting, I will give more than counsel. Take my horse, and I will run a while, and when I am weary we shall change again, that so, riding and running, both may go the speedier. So the change was made, and they went forward as briskly as they durst on the uneven causeway, Dick with his hand upon the other's knee.
How call ye your name? Asked Dick.
Call me John Matcham, replied the lad.
And what make ye to Hollywood? Dick continued.
"I seek sanctuary from a man that would oppress me," was the answer. The good abbot of Hollywood is a strong pillar to the weak.
"And how came ye with Sir Daniel, Master Matcham?" pursued Dick.
"Nay," cried the other, "by the abuse of force. He hath taken me by violence from my own place, dressed me in these weeds, ridden with me till my heart was sick, gibed me till I could a wept, and when certain of my friends pursued, thinking to have me back, claps me in the rear to stand their shot. I was even grazed in the right foot, and walked but lamely. Nay, there shall come a day between us, he shall smart for all."
"Would ye shoot at the moon with a handgun?" said Dick. "'Tis a valiant knight, and hath a hand of iron. An he guessed I had made or meddled with your flight, it would go sore with me."
"Eh, poor boy," returned the other, "why are his ward, I know it. By the same token, so am I, or so he saith, or else he hath bought my marriage I wot not rightly which, but it is some handle to oppress me by."
"Boy again," said Dick.
"Nay, then, shall I call you girl, good Richard?" asked Matcham.
"Never a girl for me," returned Dick. "I do abjure the crew of them."
"Ye speak boyishly," said the other. "Ye think more of them than ye pretend."
"Not I," said Dick, stoutly. "They come not in my mind. A plague of them, say I. Give me to hunt and to fight and to feast, and to live with jolly foresters. I never heard of a maid yet that was for any service, save one only, and she, poor shrew, was burnt for a witch in the wearing of men's clothes in spite of nature."
Master Matcham crossed himself with fervor, and appeared to pray.
"What make ye?" Dick inquired.
"I pray for her spirit," answered the other, with a somewhat troubled voice.
"For a witch's spirit?" Dick cried. "But pray for her, an ye list, she was the best wench in Europe, was this Joan of Arc. Old Appleyard the archer ran from her," he said, "as if she had been Mahound. Nay, she was a brave wench."
"Well, but, good Master Richard," resumed Matcham, "an ye like maids so little, why are no true natural man, for God made them twain by intention, and brought true love into the world, to be man's hope and woman's comfort."
"Faw," said Dick. "Why are a milk-supping baby, so to harp on women? An ye think I be no true man, get down upon the path, and whether it fists, back sword, or bow and arrow, I will prove my manhood on your body."
"Nay, I am no fighter," said Matcham, eagerly. "I mean no tittle of offence. I meant but pleasantry. And if I talk of women, it is because I heard ye were to marry."
"I to marry?" Dick exclaimed. "Well, it is the first I hear of it. And with whom was I to marry?"
"One Joan Sedley," replied Matcham, colouring. "It was Sir Daniel's doing, he hath money to gain upon both sides, and, indeed, I have heard the poor wench bemoaning herself pitifully of the match. It seems she is of your mind, or else distasted to the bridegroom."
"Well, marriage is like death, it comes to all," said Dick, with resignation. "And she bemoaned herself? I pray ye now, see there how shuttle-witted are these girls, to bemoan herself before that she had seen me. Do I bemoan myself? Not I. An I be to marry, I will marry dry-eyed. But if ye know her, prithee, of what favour is she? Fair or foul? And is she shrewish or pleasant?"
"Nay, what matters it?" said Matcham. "And why art to marry, ye can but marry. What matters foul or fair? These be but toys. Why are no milksop, Master Richard, ye will wed with dry eyes, anyhow."
"It is well said," replied Shelton. "Little I reck."
"Your lady wife is like to have a pleasant lord," said Matcham.
"She shall have the lord heaven made her for," returned Dick. "It trow there be worse as well as better."
"Ah, the poor wench!" cried the other.
"And why so poor?" asked Dick.
"To wed a man of wood," replied his companion. "O me, for a wooden husband!
I think I be a man of wood, indeed," said Dick, "to trudge afoot the while you ride my horse, but it is good wood, I trow."
"Good Dick, forgive me," cried the other.
"Nay, why are the best heart in England," I but laughed.
"Forgive me now, sweet Dick."
"Nay, no fool words," returned Dick, a little embarrassed by his companion's warmth. "No harm is done. I am not touchy, praise the saints." And at that moment the wind, which was blowing straight behind them as they went, brought them the rough flourish of Sir Daniel's trumpeter.
"Hark!" said Dick, "the tucket soundeth."
"Eh," said Matcham, "they have found my flight, and now I am unhorsed." And he became pale as death.
"Nay, what cheer?" returned Dick. "Why have a long start, and we are near the ferry. And it is I, methinks, that am unhorsed.
"Alack, I shall be taken," cried the fugitive.
"Dick, kind Dick, beseech ye help me but a little."
"Why, now, what aileth thee?" said Dick.
"Methinks I help you very patently. But my heart is sorry for so spiritless a fellow. And see here, John Matcham, sith John Matcham is your name, I, Richard Shelton, tide what betideth, come what may, will see you safe in Hollywood. The saints so do to me again if I default you. Come, pick me up a good heart, Sir Whiteface. The way better's here, spur me the horse. Go faster. Faster.
Nay, mind not for me, I can run like a deer."
So, with the horse trotting hard, and Dick running easily alongside, they crossed the remainder of the fen, and came out upon the banks of the river by the ferryman's hut.
Chapter 3 The Fen Ferry.
The river Till was a wide, sluggish, clay water, oozing out of fens, and in this part of its course it strained among some score of willow-covered, marshy islets. It was a dingy stream, but upon this bright, spirited morning everything was become beautiful. The wind and the martens broke it up into innumerable dimples, and the reflection of the sky was scattered over all the surface in crumbs of smiling blue. A creek ran up to meet the path, and close under the bank the ferryman's hut lay snugly. It was of wattle and clay, and the grass grew green upon the roof. Dick went to the door and opened it. Within, upon a foul old russet cloak, the ferryman lay stretched and shivering, a great hulk of a man, but lean and shaken by the country fever.
"Hey, Master Shelton," he said, "be ye for the ferry? Ill times, ill times. Look to yourself. There is a fellowship abroad. Ye were better turn round on your two heels and try the bridge."
"Nay, time's in the saddle," answered Dick. "Time will ride, Hugh Ferryman. I am hot in haste."
"A willful man," returned the ferryman, rising. "And ye went safe to the moat house, why have done lucky, but I say no more." And then catching sight of Matcham, "Who be this?" he asked, as he paused, blinking, on the threshold of his cabin.
"It is my kinsman, Master Matcham," answered Dick.
"Give ye good day, good ferryman," said Matcham, who had dismounted, and now came forward, leading the horse.
"Launch me your boat, I prithee, we are sore in haste."
The gaunt ferryman continued staring. "By the mass," he cried at length, and laughed with open throat. Matcham colored to his neck and winced, and Dick, with an angry countenance, put his hand on the lout's shoulder.
"How now, churl?" he cried. "Fall to thy business, and leave mocking thy betters."
Hugh Ferryman grumblingly undid his boat, and shoved it a little forth into the deep water. Then Dick led in the horse, and Matcham followed.
"Ye be mortal small made, master," said Hugh, with a wide grin, "something of the wrong model, belike.
Nay, Master Shelton, I am for you," he added, getting to his oars. "A cat may look at a king. I did but take a shot of the eye at Master Matcham."
"Sirrah, no more words," said Dick. "Bend me your back."
They were by that time at the mouth of the creek, and the view opened up and down the river. Everywhere it was enclosed with islands. Clay banks were falling in, willows nodding, reeds waving, martens dipping and piping. There was no sign of man in the labyrinth of waters.
"My master," said the ferryman, keeping the boat steady with one oar, "I have a shrew guess that John Fenn is on the island. He bears me a black grudge to all Sir Daniels. How if I turned me upstream and landed you an arrow flight above the path? Ye were best not meddle with John Fenn."
"How, then? Is he of this company?" asked Dick.
"Nay, mum is the word," said Hugh. "But I would go up water, Dick. How if Master Matcham came by an arrow?" And he laughed again.
"Be it so, Hugh," answered Dick.
"Look ye, then," pursued Hugh. "Sith it shall so be, unsling me your crossbow so, now make it ready good, place me a quarrel. Eh, keep it so, and look upon me grimly."
"What meaneth this?" asked Dick.
"Why, my master, if I steal you across, it must be under force or fear," replied the ferryman, "for else, if John Fenn got wind of it, he were like to prove my most distressful neighbor."
"Do these churls ride so roughly?" Dick inquired. "Do they command Sir Daniel's own ferry?"
"Nay," whispered the ferryman, winking. "Mark me. Sir Daniel shall down. His time is out. He shall down. Mum." And he bent over his oars.
They pulled a long way up the river, turned the tail of an island, and came softly down a narrow channel next the opposite bank. Then Hugh held water in midstream.
"I must land you here among the willows," he said.
"Here is no path but willow swamps and quagmires," answered Dick.
"Master Shelton," replied Hugh,
I dare not take ye near or down, for your own sake now. He watcheth me the fairy, lying on his bow. All that go by and owe Sir Daniel goodwill, he shooteth down like rabbits. I heard him swear it by the rood. And I had not known you of old days, eh, and from so high upward I would let you go on, but for old days' remembrance, and because ye had this toy with you that's not fit for wounds or warfare, I did risk my two poor ears to have you over whole. Content you, I can no more, on my salvation. Hugh was still speaking, lying on his oars, when there came a great shout from among the willows on the island, and sounds followed as of a strong man breasting roughly through the wood. A Murrain! Cried Hugh. He was on the upper island all the while. He pulled straight for shore. Threat me with your bow, good Dick, threat me with it plain, he added. I have tried to save your skins, save you mine. The boat ran into a tough thicket of willows with a crash. Matcham, pale, but steady and alert, at a sign from Dick, ran along the thwarts and leapt ashore. Dick, taking the horse by the bridle, sought to follow, but what with the animal's bulk, and what with the closeness of the thicket, both stuck fast. The horse neighed and trampled, and the boat, which was swinging in an eddy, came on and off and pitched with violence. It may not be, Hugh, here is no landing, cried Dick, but he still struggled valiantly with the obstinate thicket and the startled animal. A tall man appeared upon the shore of the island, a long bow in his hand. Dick saw him for an instant, with the corner of his eye, bending the bow with a great effort, his face crimson with hurry. Who goes? He shouted. Hugh, who goes? 'Tis Master Shelton, John, replied the ferryman. Stand, Dick Shelton, bawled the man upon the island. Ye shall have no hurt, upon the rood. Stand. Back out, Hugh ferryman. Dick cried a taunting answer. Nay, then, ye shall go afoot, returned the man, and he let drive an arrow. The horse, struck by the shaft, lashed out in agony and terror, the boat capsized, and the next moment all were struggling in the eddies of the river. When Dick came up, he was within a yard of the bank, and before his eyes were clear, his hand had closed on something firm and strong that instantly began to drag him forward. It was the riding rod, that Matcham, crawling forth upon an overhanging willow, had opportunely thrust into his grasp. By the mass! Cried Dick, as he was helped ashore, that makes a life I owe you. I swim like a cannonball. And he turned instantly towards the island. Midway over, Hugh ferryman was swimming with his upturned boat, while John F.N., furious at the ill fortune of his shot, bawled to him to hurry. Come, Jack, said Shelton, run for it. Ere Hugh can hail his barge across, or the pair of 'em can get it righted, we may be out of cry. And adding example to his words, he began to run, dodging among the willows, and in marshy places leaping from tussock to tussock. He had no time to look for his direction, all he could do was to turn his back upon the river, and put all his heart to running. Presently, however, the ground began to rise, which showed him he was still in the right way, and soon after they came forth upon a slope of solid turf, where elms began to mingle with the willows. But here Matcham, who had been dragging far into the rear, threw himself fairly down. Leave me, Dick! He cried, pantingly, I can no more. Dick turned, and came back to where his companion lay. Nay, Jack, leave thee! He cried. That were a knave's trick, to be sure, when ye risked a shot and a ducking, ay, and a drowning too, to save my life. Drowning, in sooth, for why I did not pull you in along with me, the saints alone can tell. Nay, said Matcham, I would a saved us both, good Dick, for I can swim. Can ye so? Cried Dick, with open eyes. It was the one manly accomplishment of which he was himself incapable. In the order of the things that he admired, next to having killed a man in single fight came swimming. Well, he said, here is a lesson to despise no man. I promise to care for you as far as Hollywood, and, by the rood, Jack, why are more capable to care for me? Well, Dick, we're friends now, said Matcham. Nay, I never was on friends, answered Dick. Why are a brave lad in your way, albeit something of a milksop, too? I never met your like before this day. But, prithee, fetch back your breath, and let us on. Here is no place for chatter. My foot hurts shrewdly, said Matcham. Nay, I had forgot your foot, returned Dick. Well, we must go the gentlier. I would I knew rightly where we were. I have clean lost the path, yet that may be for the better, too. And they watch the ferry, they watch the path, belike, as well. I would Sir Daniel were back with 20 men, he would sweep me these rascals as the wind sweeps leaves. Come,
Jack, lean ye on my shoulder, ye poor shrew.
Nay, why are not dull enough?
What age are ye, for a wager?
12?
Nay, I am 16, said Matcham.
Why are poorly grown to height, then, answered Dick.
But take my hand. We shall go softly, never fear. I owe you a life, I am a good repair, Jack, of good or evil.
They began to go forward up the slope.
We must hit the road, early or late, continued Dick, and then for a fresh start.
By the mass. But why have a rickety hand, Jack? If I had a hand like that, I would think shame.
I tell you, he went on, with a sudden chuckle, I swear by the mass I believe Hugh Ferryman took you for a maid.
Nay, never, cried the other, coloring high.
I did, though, for a wager, Dick exclaimed. Small blame to him.
Ye look liker maid than man, and I tell you more why are a strange-looking rogue for a boy, but for a hussy, Jack, ye would be right fair ye would.
Ye would be well favored for a wench.
Well, said Matcham, ye know right well that I am none.
Nay, I know that, I do but jest, said Dick.
Ye'll be a man before your mother, Jack.
What cheer, my bully?
Ye shall strike shrewd strokes. Now, which, I marvel, of you or me, shall be first knighted, Jack?
For knighted I shall be, or die for tea.
Sir Richard Shelton, knight, it soundeth bravely. But Sir John Matcham soundeth not amiss.
Prithee, Dick, stop till I drink, said the other, pausing where a little clear spring welled out of the slope into a graveled basin no bigger than a pocket.
And oh, Dick, if I might come by anything to eat. My very heart aches with hunger.
Why, fool, did ye not eat at Ketley? Asked Dick.
I had made a vow it was a sin I had been led into, stammered Matcham, but now, if it were but dry bread, I would eat it greedily.
Sit ye, then, and eat, said Dick, while that I scout a little forward for the road.
And he took a wallet from his girdle, wherein were bread and pieces of dry bacon, and, while Matcham fell heartily to, struck farther forth among the trees.
A little beyond there was a dip in the ground, where a streamlet soaked among dead leaves, and beyond that, again, the trees were better grown and stood wider, and oak and beech began to take the place of willow and elm. The continued tossing and pouring of the wind among the leaves sufficiently concealed the sounds of his footsteps on the mast. It was for the ear what a moonless night is to the eye, but for all that Dick went cautiously, slipping from one big trunk to another, and looking sharply about him as he went. Suddenly a doe passed like a shadow through the underwood in front of him, and he paused, disgusted at the chance. This part of the wood had been certainly deserted, but now that the poor deer had run, she was like a messenger he should have sent before him to announce his coming, and instead of pushing farther, he turned him to the nearest well-grown tree, and rapidly began to climb. Luck had served him well. The oak on which he had mounted was one of the tallest in that quarter of the wood, and easily outtopped its neighbors by a fathom and a half, and when Dick had clambered into the topmost fork and clung there, swinging dizzily in the great wind, he saw behind him the whole fenny plain as far as Ketley, and the Till wandering among woody islets, and in front of him, the white line of high road winding through the forest. The boat had been righted; it was even now midway on the ferry. Beyond that there was no sign of man, nor aught moving but the wind. He was about to descend, when, taking a last view, his eye lit upon a string of moving points about the middle of the fen. Plainly a small troop was threading the causeway, and that at a good pace, and this gave him some concern as he shinned vigorously down the trunk and returned across the wood for his companion.
Chapter 4 A Greenwood Company. Matcham was well rested and revived, and the two lads, winged by what Dick had seen, hurried through the remainder of the outwood, crossed the road in safety, and began to mount into the high ground of Tunstall Forest. The trees grew more and more in groves, with heathy places in between, sandy, gorsy, and dotted with old yews. The ground became more and more uneven, full of pits and hillocks. And with every step of the ascent the wind still blew the shriller, and the trees bent before the gusts like fishing rods. They had just entered one of the clearings, when Dick suddenly clapped down upon his face among the brambles, and began to crawl slowly backward towards the shelter of the grove. Matcham, in great bewilderment, for he could see no reason for this flight, still imitated his companion's course, and it was not until they had gained the harbor of a thicket that he turned and begged him to explain. For all reply, Dick pointed with his finger. At the far end of the clearing, a fir grew high above the neighboring wood, and planted its black shock of foliage clear against the sky. For about 50 feet above the ground the trunk grew straight and solid like a column. At that level, it split into two massive boughs, and in the fork, like a mast-headed seaman, there stood a man in a green tabard, spying far and wide.
The sun glistened upon his hair, with one hand he shaded his eyes to look abroad, and he kept slowly rolling his head from side to side, with the regularity of a machine. The lads exchanged glances.
"Let us try to the left," said Dick. "We had near fallen foully, Jack."
10 minutes afterwards they struck into a beaten path.
"Here is a piece of forest that I know not," Dick remarked. "Where goeth me this track?"
"Let us even try," said Matcham. A few yards further, the path came to the top of a ridge and began to go down abruptly into a cup-shaped hollow. At the foot, out of a thick wood of flowering hawthorn, two or three roofless gables, blackened as if by fire, and a single tall chimney marked the ruins of a house.
"What may this be?" whispered Matcham.
"Nay, by the mass, I know not," answered Dick. "I am all at sea. Let us go warily." With beating hearts, they descended through the hawthorns. Here and there, they passed signs of recent cultivation. Fruit trees and pot herbs ran wild among the thicket, a sundial had fallen in the grass, it seemed they were treading what once had been a garden. Yet a little farther and they came forth before the ruins of the house. It had been a pleasant mansion and a strong. A dry ditch was dug deep about it, but it was now choked with masonry, and bridged by a fallen rafter. The two farther walls still stood, the sun shining through their empty windows, but the remainder of the building had collapsed, and now lay in a great cairn of ruin, grimed with fire. Already in the interior a few plants were springing green among the chinks.
"Now I bethink me," whispered Dick, "this must be Grimstone. It was a hold of one Simon Malmesbury, Sir Daniel was his bane. 'Twas Bennett Hatch that burned it, now 5 years agone. In sooth, 'twas pity, for it was a fair house." Down in the hollow, where no wind blew, it was both warm and still, and Matcham, laying one hand upon Dick's arm, held up a warning finger.
"Hist!" he said. Then came a strange sound, breaking on the quiet. It was twice repeated ere they recognized its nature. It was the sound of a big man clearing his throat, and just then a hoarse, untuneful voice broke into singing. Then up and spake the master, the king of the outlaws, "What make ye here, my merry men, among the greenwood shaws?" And Gamelin made answer he looked never adown, "Oh, they must need to walk in wood that may not walk in town." The singer paused, a faint clink of iron followed, and then silence. The two lads stood looking at each other. Whoever he might be, their invisible neighbor was just beyond the ruin. And suddenly the color came into Matcham's face, and next moment he had crossed the fallen rafter, and was climbing cautiously on the huge pile of lumber that filled the interior of the roofless house. Dick would have withheld him, had he been in time, as it was, he was fain to follow. Right in the corner of the ruin, two rafters had fallen crosswise, and protected a clear space no larger than a pew in church. Into this the lads silently lowered themselves. There they were perfectly concealed, and through a narrow loophole commanded a view upon the farther side. Peering through this, they were struck stiff with terror at their predicament. To retreat was impossible, they scarce dared to breathe. Upon the very margin of the ditch, not 30 feet from where they crouched, an iron cauldron bubbled and steamed above a glowing fire, and close by, in an attitude of listening, as though he had caught some sound of their clambering among the ruins, a tall, red-faced, battered-looking man stood poised, an iron spoon in his right hand, a horn and a formidable dagger at his belt. Plainly this was the singer, plainly he had been stirring the cauldron, when some incautious step among the lumber had fallen upon his ear. A little further off, another man lay slumbering, rolled in a brown cloak, with a butterfly hovering above his face. All this was in a clearing white with daisies, and at the extreme verge, a bow, a sheaf of arrows, and part of a deer's carcass, hung upon a flowering hawthorn. Presently the fellow relaxed from his attitude of attention, raised the spoon to his mouth, tasted its contents, nodded, and then fell again to stirring and singing. "Oh, they must need to walk in wood that may not walk in town," he croaked, taking up his song where he had left it.
"Oh, sir, we walk not here at all, an evil thing to do. But if we meet with the good king's deer to shoot a shaft into." Still as he sang, he took from time to time, another spoonful of the broth, blew upon it, and tasted it, with all the airs of an experienced cook. At length, apparently, he judged the mess was ready, for taking the horn from his girdle, he blew 3 modulated calls. The other fellow awoke, rolled over, brushed away the butterfly, and looked about him.
"How now, brother?" he said. "Dinner?"
"Eh, sod," replied the cook, "dinner it is, and a dry dinner, too, with neither ale nor bread. But there is little pleasure in the greenwood now. Time was when a good fellow could live here like a mitred abbot, set aside the rain and the white frosts, he had his heart's desire both of ale and wine.
But now our men's spirits dead, and this John amend all, save us and guard us. But a stuffed booby to scare crows withal. Nay, returned the other, why are two set on meat and drinking, lawless? Bide ye a bit, the good time cometh. Look ye, returned the cook, I have even waited for this good time sith that I was so high. I have been a grey friar, I have been a king's archer, I have been a shipman, and sailed the salt seas, and I have been in Greenwood before this, forsooth. And shot the king's deer. What cometh of it? Naught. I were better to have bided in the cloister. John Abbot availeth more than John Amendall. By Our Lady. Here they come. One after another, tall, likely fellows began to stroll into the lawn. Each as he came produced a knife and a horn cup, helped himself from the cauldron, and sat down upon the grass to eat. They were very variously equipped and armed, some in rusty smocks, and with nothing but a knife and an old bow, others in the height of forest gallantry, all in Lincoln green, both hood and jerkin, with dainty peacock arrows in their belts, a horn upon a baldric, and a sword and dagger at their sides. They came in the silence of hunger, and scarce growled a salutation, but fell instantly to meat. There were, perhaps, a score of them already gathered, when a sound of suppressed cheering arose close by among the hawthorns, and immediately after five or six woodmen carrying a stretcher debouched upon the lawn. A tall, lusty fellow, somewhat grizzled, and as brown as a smoked ham, walked before them with an air of some authority, his bow at his back, a bright boar spear in his hand. Lads! He cried, good fellows all, and my right merry friends, why have sung this while on a dry whistle and lived at little ease? But what said I ever? Abide fortune constantly, she turneth swift. And lo! Here is her little firstling even that good creature, ale. There was a murmur of applause as the bearer set down the stretcher and displayed a goodly cask. And now haste ye, boys, the man continued. There is work toward. A handful of archers are but now come to the ferry, murrey and blue is their wear, they are our butts, they shall all taste arrows, no man of them shall struggle through this wood. For, lads, we are here some 50 strong, each man of us most foully wronged, for some they have lost lands, and some friends, and some they have been outlawed all oppressed. Who, then, hath done this evil? Sir Daniel, by the rood. Shall he then profit? Shall he sit snug in our houses? Shall he till our fields? Shall he suck the bone he robbed us of? I trow not. He getteth him strength at law, he gaineth cases, nay, there is one case he shall not gain. I have a writ here at my belt that, please the saints, shall conquer him. Lawless the cook was by this time already at his second horn of ale. He raised it, as if to pledge the speaker. Master Ellis, he said, why are for vengeance well it becometh you? But your poor brother of the greenwood, that had never lands to lose nor friends to think upon, looketh rather, for his poor part, to the profit of the thing. He had liever a gold noble and a pottle of canary wine than all the vengeances in purgatory. Lawless, replied the other, to reach the moat house, Sir Daniel must pass the forest. We shall make that passage dearer, party, than any battle. Then, when he hath got to earth with such ragged handful as escapeth us all his great friends fallen and fled away, and none to give him aid, we shall beleaguer that old fox about, and great shall be the fall of him. 'Tis a fat buck, he will make a dinner for us all. Ay, returned Lawless, I have eaten many of these dinners beforehand, but the cooking of them is hot work, good Master Ellis. And meanwhile what do we? We make black arrows, we write rhymes, and we drink fair cold water, that discomfortable drink. Why are untrue, Will Lawless? Ye still smell of the Grey Friar's buttery, greed is your undoing, answered Ellis. We took 20 pounds from Appleyard. We took 7 marks from the messenger last night. A day ago we had 50 from the merchant. And today, said one of the men, I stopped a fat pardoner riding apace for Hollywood. Here is his purse. Ellis counted the contents. 50 shillings. He grumbled. Fool, he had more in his sandal, or stitched into his tippet. Why are but a child, Tom Cuckow, ye have lost the fish. But, for all that, Ellis pocketed the purse with nonchalance. He stood leaning on his boar spear, and looked round upon the rest. They, in various attitudes, took greedily of the venison pottage, and liberally washed it down with ale. This was a good day, they were in luck, but business pressed, and they were speedy in their eating. The first comers had by this time even dispatched their dinner. Some lay down upon the grass and fell instantly asleep, like boa constrictors, others talked together, or overhauled their weapons, and one, whose humor was particularly gay, holding forth an ale horn, began to sing. Here is no law in good green shaw, here is no lack of meat,
'Tis merry and quiet, with deer for our diet, in summer, when all is sweet. Come winter again, with wind and rain come winter, with snow and sleet, get home to your places, with hoods on your faces, and sit by the fire and eat. All this while the two lads had listened and lain close, only Richard had unslung his crossbow, and held ready in one hand the windac, or grappling iron that he used to bend it. Otherwise they had not dared to stir, and this scene of forest life had gone on before their eyes like a scene upon a theatre. But now there came a strange interruption. The tall chimney which overtopped the remainder of the ruins rose right above their hiding place. There came a whistle in the air, and then a sounding smack, and the fragments of a broken arrow fell about their ears. Someone from the upper quarters of the wood, perhaps the very sentinel they saw posted in the fir, had shot an arrow at the chimney top. Matcham could not restrain a little cry, which he instantly stifled, and even Dick started with surprise, and dropped the windac from his fingers. But to the fellows on the lawn, this shaft was an expected signal. They were all afoot together, tightening their belts, testing their bowstrings, loosening sword and dagger in the sheath. Ellis held up his hand, his face had suddenly assumed a look of savage energy, the white of his eyes shone in his sun-brown face. "Lads," he said, "ye know your places. Let not one man's soul escape you. Appleyard was a wet before a meal, but now we go to table. I have three men whom I will bitterly avenge: Harry Shelton, Simon Malmesbury, and," striking his broad bosom, "and Ellis Duckworth, by the mass." Another man came, red with hurry, through the thorns. "'Tis not Sir Daniel," he panted. "They are but seven. Is the arrow gone?" "It struck but now," replied Ellis. "A murrain," cried the messenger. "Methought I heard it whistle. And I go dinnerless." In the space of a minute, some running, some walking sharply, according as their stations were nearer or farther away, the men of the Black Arrow had all disappeared from the neighborhood of the ruined house, and the cauldron, and the fire, which was now burning low, and the dead deer's carcass on the hawthorn, remained alone to testify they had been there. Chapter 5. Bloody as the Hunter. The lads lay quiet till the last footstep had melted on the wind. Then they arose, and with many an ache, for they were weary with constraint, clambered through the ruins, and recrossed the ditch upon the rafter. Matcham had picked up the windac and went first, Dick following stiffly, with his crossbow on his arm. "And now," said Matcham, "forth to Hollywood." "To Hollywood," cried Dick, "when good fellows stand shot. Not I. I would see you hanged first, Jack."
"Ye would leave me, would ye?" Matcham asked.
"Eh, by my sooth," returned Dick. "An I be not in time to warn these lads, I will go die with them.
What?
Would ye have me leave my own men that I have lived among?
I trow not.
Give me my windac." But there was nothing further for Matcham's mind. "Dick," he said, "ye sware before the saints that ye would see me safe to Hollywood. Would ye be forsworn? Would you desert me, a perjurer?"
"Nay, I sware for the best," returned Dick. "I meant it too, but now. But look ye, Jack, turn again with me. Let me but warn these men, and, if needs must, stand shot with them, then shall all be clear, and I will on again to Hollywood and purge my oath."
"Ye but deride me," answered Matcham. "These men ye go to succor are the I same that hunt me to my ruin." Dick scratched his head.
"I cannot help it, Jack," he said. "Here is no remedy. What would ye? Ye run no great peril, man, and these are in the way of death.
Death," he added. "Think of it. What a murrain do ye keep me here for? Give me the windac.
St. George. Shall they all die?"
"Richard Shelton," said Matcham, looking him squarely in the face, "would ye, then, join party with Sir Daniel? Have ye not ears? Heard ye not this Ellis, what he said? Or have ye no heart for your own kindly blood and the father that men slew?
Harry Shelton," he said, "and Sir Harry Shelton was your father, as the sun shines in heaven."
"What would ye?" Dick cried again. "Would ye have me credit thieves?"
"Nay, I have heard it before now," returned Matcham. "The fame goeth currently, it was Sir Daniel slew him. He slew him under oath, in his own house he shed the innocent blood. Heaven wearies for the avenging aunt, and you, the man's son, you go about to comfort and defend the murderer."
"Jack," cried the lad, "I know not. It may be, what know I? But, see here, this man hath bred me up and fostered me, and his men I have hunted with and played among, and to leave them in the hour of peril, oh, man, if I did that, I were stark dead to honor.
Nay, Jack, ye would not ask it, ye would not wish me to be base."
"But your father, Dick?" said Matcham, somewhat wavering.
"Your father? And your oath to me?
ye took the saints to witness.
My father? Cried Shelton. Nay, he would have me go. If Sir Daniel slew him, when the hour comes this hand shall slay Sir Daniel, but neither him nor his will I desert in peril. And for mine oath, good Jack, ye shall absolve me of it here. For the lives' sake of many men that hurt you not, and for mine honour, ye shall set me free.
I, Dick? Never. Returned Matcham.
An ye leave me, why are forsworn, and so I shall declare it.
My blood heats, said Dick. Give me the windac. Give it me.
I'll not, said Matcham. I'll save you in your teeth.
Not? Cried Dick. I'll make you.
Try it, said the other. They stood, looking in each other's eyes, each ready for a spring. Then Dick leapt, and though Matcham turned instantly and fled, in two bounds he was overtaken, the windac was twisted from his grasp, he was thrown roughly to the ground, and Dick stood across him, flushed and menacing, with doubled fist. Matcham lay where he had fallen, with his face in the grass, not thinking of resistance. Dick bent his bow.
I'll teach you. He cried, fiercely. Oath or no oath, ye may go hang for me.
And he turned and began to run. Matcham was on his feet at once, and began running after him.
What do ye want? Cried Dick, stopping. What make ye after me?
Stand off.
We'll follow an I please, said Matcham. This wood is free to me.
Stand back, by Our Lady. Returned Dick, raising his bow.
Ah, why are a brave boy? Retorted Matcham. Shoot.
Dick lowered his weapon in some confusion.
See here, he said. Why have done me ill enough?
Go, then. Go your way in fair wise, or, whether I will or not, I must even drive you to it.
Well, said Matcham, doggedly, why are the stronger? Do your worst.
I shall not leave to follow thee, Dick, unless thou makest me, he added.
Dick was almost beside himself. It went against his heart to beat a creature so defenseless, and, for the life of him, he knew no other way to rid himself of this unwelcome and, as he began to think, perhaps untrue companion.
Why are mad, I think, he cried. Fool fellow, I am hasting to your foes, as fast as foot can carry me, go I thither.
I care not, Dick, replied the lad. If why are bound to die, Dick, I'll die too. I would liever go with you to prison than to go free without you.
Well, returned the other, I may stand no longer prating. Follow me, if ye must, but if ye play me false, it shall but little advance you, mark ye that. Shalt have a quarrel in thine inwards, boy.
So saying, Dick took once more to his heels, keeping in the margin of the thicket and looking briskly about him as he went. At a good pace he rattled out of the dell, and came again into the more open quarters of the wood. To the left a little eminence appeared, spotted with golden gorse, and crowned with a black tuft of firs. I shall see from there, he thought, and struck for it across a heathy clearing. He had gone but a few yards, when Matcham touched him on the arm, and pointed. To the eastward of the summit there was a dip, and, as it were, a valley passing to the other side. The heath was not yet out, all the ground was rusty, like an unscoured buckler, and dotted sparingly with yews, and there, one following another, Dick saw half a score green jerkins mounting the ascent, and marching at their head, conspicuous by his boar spear, Alastockworth in person.